Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast, never podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you go to the events page and register for the regional event in Northwest Arkansas. You're going to want to be at that. It's April 22nd and 23rd. It's a lot of fun, guys, and it's got a great roster this year. Chad's going to be there. That's probably the only thing you need to know as a listener to this program. Chad will be there. I'll be there, of course. Eric Sorensen will be there, and Scott Keith will be there, and Kelsey Calabaro will be there, and Dan Van Voris will be there, and Caleb Keith will be there, and Scott Davis will be there, and Blake Flatley will be doing music, and Andy Gullihorn and Jill Phillips will be doing music. I mean, I don't know how much more selling I need to do. It's only $99 for a two-day event, a Friday and Saturday event, so get that ticket, get those travel arrangements made, get that hotel, too. I was talking to Lana Chad yesterday, and for those of you who don't know, Lana's the one who makes sure that we have places to stay when we go places. Chad and I don't do those kind of things, not because we're above it, but because we'd mess it up. You know, she was saying, you know, that the hotels even here get booked up quick. This isn't such a place where there's nothing going on, and so if you're gonna come, get those arrangements made, and come on down to Northwest Arkansas and hang out with us. All right, Chad, we are still in 1 Kings 8. You know, I didn't have 1 Kings 8 circled as a chapter that we would spend multiple episodes in. I mean, I think now this is the third episode we've been in it to some degree.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of surprising. I didn't foresee that either, but turns out the more that you kind of, I don't know, you know, just steep yourselves in these verses, there's more to talk about. I guess because any section of scripture that tends to look forward and look back at the same time,
yeah,
tends to just invite more time to reflect upon it, because you're always asking yourself, exactly what is he like looking back to? What are the actions of God in the past, the promises of God in the past that he's referring to or alluding to, and what is he looking forward to? And we saw plenty of that too, where there's already this kind of this dark cloud on the horizon, the dark cloud of exile that's hinted at, especially in that last petition where he talks about basically when your people rebel for everybody's sins and they end up cast out and they're far away from you, then hear them when they're in their captivity in their iron furnace of the future. So yeah, kind of makes sense. You know, when you stop to think about it, there's so much here that takes a while, but we're going to finish it today for sure. And then we'll work our way into chapter 9 as well. I think what we're beginning with here is 1 Kings 8:54, which is when Solomon's going to finish his prayer.
Yeah, I feel like we teased the Queen of Sheba like a lot of episodes ago, and we said it like it was coming up real soon, and then we just stretched this sort of dedication and then this prayer and now this benediction, and I just wasn't expecting to spend an episode on each.
Yeah. Well, but we've been watching too many Netflix dramas. They do the same thing.
That's right. Like, well,
there's a lot of going to happen, and then like 8 episodes later, it finally happens.
It happens, man. This is part of the joy of going through the Old Testament like this. Is you have a different list of sneaky deep chapters of the Bible where you're like, hey, you know what chapter is deep that you didn't know was deep? 1 Kings 8.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. So the verse begins. 1 Kings 8:54, that Solomon finished. So he finished offering all this prayer and plea to the Lord. And we're told that he got up. He arose from before the altar of the Lord, where he had knelt with his hands outstretched toward heaven. So this is one of those somewhat rare occasions where we actually are given the posture of prayer, what it looks like. I think we talked about this a couple episodes ago where, you know, typically people will pray with their hands outstretched, palms up in a receptive posture. But here we're told that Solomon was actually kneeling before that for that altar. Then he stood and presumably turned around, so he was facing the altar, praying toward God. And then he turns around and blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, "Blessed be the Lord who has given rest to his people Israel, according to all that he promised." Of course, we've mentioned multiple times already in 1 Kings that 1 and 2 Kings is concerned a lot with the fulfillment of prophecy of various sorts. A lot of what we've seen so far is the fulfillment of God's promises to David, of course. So 2 Samuel 7 talked about all this stuff that God was going to do for David. And we've seen multiple references to that, especially from the lips of Solomon himself, how God is fulfilling what he swore to his father David. Now he's going to refer back to not something that God had promised to David, but actually all the way back to Moses. The word that's used here for rest, menucha, is the same word that is spoken by Moses back in Deuteronomy 12. So Solomon says, blessed be the Lord who has given rest to his people Israel according to all that he promised. Now you go back to Deuteronomy 12 and you read, you shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everybody doing what's right in his own eyes. So this is Solomon saying, this is Moses saying, hey, we can't continue this. For, he goes on, for you have not as yet come to the manucha, to the rest, and to the inheritance that the Lord your God is giving you. And then he goes on to talk about how God is going to provide a place for the people of Israel. And in that place, they're going to have rest. So Solomon is saying, hey, what Moses talked about generations before in Deuteronomy chapter 12, this rest that God was going to give to his people Israel, well, we got it. That's what this is. We have the house for God, we have the dynasty established, and now God has given us this rest that he promised. And then he goes on to say, not one word has failed of all his good promises, which he spoke by Moses, his servant. So not one thing has fallen, is the Hebrew idiom there. So nothing has failed. Nothing has failed to happen of all that God promised to Israel via Moses.
You know, rest might be an unlikely theme in the Bible. It's something you might not think was going to show up the way that it does. But ever since sort of God pronounces what this death that Adam and Eve have earned by disobeying him, eating the fruit that they ought not eat, this death is attached to not just, hey, you're going to die someday, but it's attached to you're going to work yourself to death. That's basically the curse. I mean, the curse is basically prepare to work yourself to death. This isn't going to be a quick thing. You're going to labor and labor and labor, and you're going to toil, and then you're going to die. And then what becomes extremely elusive is rest. You never get to rest after this. And then you have all kinds of sin. And what sin does is it makes everyone restless. There's no rest with sin. I mean, whether someone's oppressing you, like the people of Israel in the time of Moses, when they're obviously slaves in Egypt, there's no rest there. And then they're wandering around the wilderness and they're searching for rest. And all the time in the scriptures, they're not looking for peace. They're not even necessarily looking for prosperity. Like that's not the thing that comes up over and over again. They want to know when they're going to enter into the rest of the Lord. Like, when can you stop? And yeah. The older you get, I think the more this rings true. It's like, when do you get to quit? Right? when is everything just going to be okay, where you can just take a deep breath and everything is just good, and you're like, I think I could rest. Even Jesus, I think that's why when he shows up on the scene and he starts dishing out promises, one of the most appealing promises, and the older you get, the more appealing it is, the closer you get to death, the more appealing it is him saying, come to me, all who are heavy laden, and I will give you not peace, not prosperity, not power, I'll give you rest. And that's because you know that that's the thing I've been trying to acquire, and it has been so elusive.
Yeah, that's one of the things that rings true with even the creation account. Mm-hmm. You get to the climax, you got 6 days where God works. He makes this, he makes that, it's all good, it's all very good. And then on the seventh day, of course, God rests. That is, it seems almost anticlimactic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. It's actually the goal. The goal is to enter into that rest, just like God entered into his rest after his six days of labor. And of course, this does become a huge theme all over the Old and New Testament. Yep. You see it in the book of Hebrews. I think it's Hebrews 4, where the author goes through, there was the rest in the beginning, and then Joshua didn't give the people rest. And then later, David in the Psalm talks about another rest. And so there remains, Hebrews says, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God.
Yeah, this is, I mean, rest is what the Sabbath is all about, right? I mean, there's literally something in the commandments about trying to figure out how to have one day out of seven as a day where you could sort of get this preview of what it is that God is promising to eventually do. Like, we want to have this little foreshadowing, and of course, we've messed it up forever. If you have worked yourself, if you've had some kind of schedule, or you've done something to where you are absolutely exhausted, and you're driving home, and maybe you've worked a triple shift or something. I've done this sort of thing, and there's nothing more that you want than to just go and stop, right? Like, if I just need to go to sleep, I just need to rest. I think it's really interesting that, you know, Solomon is doing this benediction, and obviously he doesn't think that this is the permanent rest, that they're never going to have to work again or anything like that, but he is saying that it's a step in the right direction, right? Like, we're getting closer to the big thing that God is going to do, which I don't even think Solomon fully understands, of course, in the rest that God is going to provide in Christ. But this is a step along that path, and he does realize that, at least.
Yeah, this whole story of just not only just Solomon, but the temple, and really multiple chapters here. It's kind of, I was trying to think this morning of how to describe it. You got two things going on at once. We're going to see this especially in chapters 9 and 10. So we've talked about how Solomon is sort of an Adam-like figure. I mean, there is this sense, you know, he's studying botany, he's studying biology, he's studying all this stuff. So he really knows the world of creation. And of course, he's wise, and he is the son of David, and he has this peaceful kingdom, and he's given rest to his people. He's built this grand house, and he has Gentiles, kings and queens coming from north and coming from south, and they're bringing riches to the kingdom. And so you do have this almost idealistic portrayal of Solomon. I mean, he is this kind of perfect, quote unquote, air quotes here, perfect king. So you got that portrayal of him as almost this unbelievable image of human perfection. Of course, I'm speaking hyperbolically here, but you know what I'm talking about. You have that going on. But at the same time, there's this shadow side of this whole story. And we've seen hints of that already. And we're going to see a lot more of it, where there's passage after passage. We'll talk about gold, 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 all this gold that Solomon is bringing in. And then it's talking about horses that he brings from Egypt. And then pretty soon, we're going to really fall off the edge, where we have him building sanctuaries for the gods of his foreign wives. And so there's that going on as well. It's almost like you can have an ideal image, but at the same time, you have a very unideal image of him. So he's reflecting both of these realities at the same time. And I think all of this is kind of, is again, to echo what I said at the beginning of the podcast, it's pointing backwards to the fall of Adam, who was also, of course, the ideal man who fell, who had everything and still fell. And then it's also pointing forward to the fulfillment that will come in the true Solomon, the true man of wisdom, the true Adam, Christ, who will give the full rest that this rest Solomon gives is only a partial fulfillment of.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, so he's given rest. Not one word has failed. And then he goes on in 57 to say, "The Lord our God be with us, as he was with our fathers. May he not leave us or forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to him, to walk in his ways, to keep his commandments, his statutes, his rules, which he commanded our fathers." Then he says, "Let these words of mine, with which I have pleaded before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night." It's kind of it's a beautiful expression, really. So let all these words, the words that we covered in the last podcast, that he pleaded before the Lord, let those words, as it were, not just kind of disappear, just be sounds that dissipate, but let them, as it were, echo in God's ears. Be near to the Lord our God day and night, and may he maintain the cause of his servant, literally do justice for his servant and for his people Israel, day by day, or each day requires. So let my prayer always be in the ears of God. May he always hear that, to do good for his people. And then he goes on to reaffirm something that we talked about also in the last podcast. Verse 60 says that, so this is the result, that all the peoples of the earth, so we're, again, not just looking within the borders of Israel, but that all the Gentile peoples too, that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord Yahweh, that is, Yahweh is God. And then we have this very welcome statement here. There is no other. So you'll often, if you read scholarly literature, you'll often read that there was this developing, I suppose we could say, developing monotheism throughout the Old Testament. As if in the early years, they really didn't believe in just one God. And then, much later is when you have this immersion of monotheism. Well, granted, yes, the people of God were always tempted into polytheism. But you have here from the lips of Solomon, just like you have other places too, this acknowledgement that, sure, to use the language of Paul, there's many gods and many lords, but really, there's only one. And as Solomon says here, there is no other.
Yeah, even among the Christian mind, it seems that polytheism is making a comeback, which is a weird thing. I wouldn't have thought that years ago that this sort of like like God's the, Yahweh's like the best of gods, but like there's lots of still gods, like powerful creatures, powerful beings out there. I mean, Yahweh might be the most powerful, but that's still polytheism.
Yeah, it's still polytheism. When scripture talks about gods, it can use that in a multitude of different ways. That is to say, when it uses Elohim, it can use that in a multitude of different ways. But it always comes back to the fact that when we're talking about God as in the divinity, the uncreated creator, then there's one. There's not a multiplicity of gods. And I think, Paul gives perfect expression of that when he's writing to the Corinthians. Of course, there's plenty of gods and lords and all of that that are out there in the world. We all know that. Polytheism is a rampant belief then and now. But there's only one. There's only one uncreated being. And so, therefore, whatever is not Yahweh is a creature. Call it what you may.
Yeah, I think the problem here is not that you can't say that there's people, and then there's God, and that's it. There's nothing else. It's not as though there's no other things. The problem becomes, I think, exactly what you said, which is when it comes to eternal, uncreated beings, there's only one of those, and he's three, but he's one, and there's only one of those, which means to speak of him as anything other than completely separate than anything else would be inappropriate. So you can't say like, oh, he's one among many gods and he's the most powerful god. That language is confusing because it doesn't put enough separation between what is created and what is uncreated.
And, now, that's definitely pagan theology there.
Yeah.
When you talk about one god among many gods, he's just the most powerful. Well, any Greek or Roman would be fine with that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, of course. Well, Zeus, yeah, he's the most powerful god. And then you have, you've got Hera and you've got all these other gods and goddesses.
And it may sound like a weird thing to bring up because, like, okay, why are you even talking about this? Well, one, it's in the text and he says, and he's making a point that there is no other, right? There is no other god. And because, oddly enough, this is something that is made a little bit of a comeback. It's weird how old things come back and in new ways. And so I've actually been having this conversation, which is a conversation 10 years ago that I would not have thought I would be having.
Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun, for sure. All these things just resurface time and time again in different dress, but they always come back. And then Solomon finishes up verse 61 with, let your heart therefore be wholly true to the Lord our God, walking in his statutes, keeping his commandments, as at this day. So that's the end. We had the prayer of Solomon, which we talked about last episode. This is the benediction that he offers afterward as he's speaking to the people. And then the chapter wraps up with basically a documentation of what all happened with regard to the celebration. So what sacrifices were offered, how many days did they celebrate, where do people come from, all those kind of details. So that we have kind of the complete picture here of just how big an event this was. So we're told 62 that the king and all Israel with him offered sacrifice before the Lord. Solomon offered as peace offerings to the Lord a whole bunch of animals, 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. So if you if you're a longtime listener to the program, you know that we talked about peace offerings when we covered Leviticus, as well as other places. There's sort of a play on words here, by the way. So Solomon's name, Shlomo in Hebrew, I've always, by the way, I thought his Hebrew name was, we should really just have stuck with his Hebrew name. Shlomo?
Yeah, sounds, like,
sounds a lot better than Solomon.
Sounds like slow. Yeah. Sounds like Shlomo.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, Shlomo. So Shlomo, his name is derived from Shalom, peace. So there's kind of a play on words here. So Shlomo offered Shalomim, peace offerings. These peace offerings were the specific kind of offering where the blood and the fat went to the Lord, were offered on his altar, and then part of the animal's meat went to the priest as his paycheck, and the rest of the animal was given back to the worshiper so that he, with his family, as well as with other people, could have a celebratory sacrificial feast. So I love the peace offerings because I think they're one of the best Old Testament parallels that we have to the Lord's Supper. So here you have the victim that is sacrificed, and then the blood is for the atonement. Blood is placed upon the altar. But then this very one whose life was given, whose blood was shed for the worshiper, is then received back and actually taken into the very body of the worshiper so that they eat the very price of their redemption.
Yeah, well, these,
which is just a beautiful picture of what the supper is about.
Yeah, these priests are about to have a huge payday, because even a portion of the meat is about to be a lot of meat. I don't know how many priests they got, but they're about to be stocked up.
Hopefully, they have some big freezers. Yeah. back in their cities. So a lot of feasting going on here. A lot of animals being offered, and we're told the king and all Israel, all the people of Israel, dedicated the house of the Lord. The Hebrew verb there is hanak. That is the root of Hanukkah. So if you're familiar with the celebration of Hanukkah, Hanukkah is not a biblical festival in the sense that it was not instituted during the scriptures. Hanukkah emerged during the Maccabean revolt, which was when the Jews revolted against their Syrian overlords, and then had to reconsecrate the temple because it had been defiled by the offering of unlawful sacrifices. And so they Hanukkah'd, they dedicated the house of the Lord, the same verb that's used here. They dedicated this house. And then we're told, it's kind of a strange scenario in verse 64, that same day, the king consecrated the middle of the court that was before the house of the Lord. For there he offered the burnt offering, the grain offering, the fat pieces, the peace offerings. Why? Because the bronze altar that was before the Lord was too small to receive the burnt offering and the grain offering and the fat pieces of the peace offering. So I guess we have the altar, even though it was pretty good size, wasn't big enough for all these sacrifices. So they had to have, a second altar to accommodate all of these sacrifices.
Yeah, it's interesting that they decided to go that direction with it. You look at all the stuff that they're sacrificing, and their conclusion is that the altar is too small, not that this offering is obviously too big.
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. This isn't an altar size problem. This is an offering size problem.
Yeah, it seems a little bit overdone to have this many offerings.
Like, is that elephant too large to fit in your car, or is that car too small to fit the elephant? Now, both these things, I guess, are true, but which direction do you believe the real problem lies?
Yeah. So first, Solomon decided he'd get a bigger truck.
Yeah.
for the elephant.
He took a look at that elephant and he said, "Man, my car is really small." And you're like, "No, I think that is just a really large elephant."
Yes. Yeah. So they to accommodate the elephant, they consecrated the middle of the court for all these sacrifices. And verse 65 tells us that they held the feast at this time. And I believe we talked a couple times ago about this was the feast here is referring to the Feast of Sukkot or Tabernacles, which was the fall festival. And appropriate time because that festival was the time when the Israelites remembered when their forefathers lived in the desert in tents. And so they would live in these temporary shelters. It's sometimes translated as a booth. But anyway, just a kind of it's a tent, more or less. And so they remembered that time. But now they're here for the Feast of Tabernacles to celebrate not a tabernacle, but the temple, the permanent structure. So they held the feast, all Israel, great assembly. And then we're used to hearing from Dan to Beersheba, right? That's kind of the typical north-south references. But here we have something else. It says from Lebo Hamath, which is in the north, to the Brook of Egypt, of course, which would be in the south. So just a different kind of north-south designation, not the one that we're accustomed to. But the impression is that people gather from the very far ends of the kingdom of Solomon to come to Jerusalem to celebrate this before the Lord our God. Well, the ESV has 7 days. The Hebrew there is actually 7 days and 7 days, 14 days. So I don't want to really get into it because it's too complicated, but sometimes your English translations, instead of going with the Hebrew text, will go with the Greek translation, Septuagint, which is what they've done here. And sometimes it makes sense. Sometimes I think, like in this case, they're just choosing something which they think fits better with the flow of the narrative. I mean, Tabernacles was technically a 7-day feast. This is a special kind of tabernacle, so it's easy to believe that Solomon decided, hey, let's just stretch this into 2 weeks. We're going to do 14 days, which is what the Hebrew would represent here. But either way, whether you go Greek, Septuagint, or Hebrew, so 14 days or 7 days, it was a celebration feast. Then verse 66 says, on the 8th day. Now, if you go with the Septuagint, this is the day after that 7-day celebration. If you go with the Hebrew, this would have been the 8th day after the second week. So technically the 15th day. But either way, at the very end of it, Solomon sends the people away. They bless the king, went to their tents, literally went to their homes, joyful, glad of heart for all the goodness that the Lord had shown to David, his servant. So it doesn't say Solomon, but to David, his servant, and to Israel, his people. So it wraps up with a statement which kind of just tries to communicate that this is sort of an acme. This is a summit of joy for the people of Israel. This is, as we discussed several episodes ago, this is the end of the Exodus because God has finally planted himself in his house on his temple. And this is a cause for celebration because God's given rest to his people. He's anointed the son of David. He's on his throne. Everybody's happy. Everybody's full. They've just feasted in this great celebration. They're able to go home joyful because of all the goodness that God has shown to David, his servant, and to the entire people of Israel. So certainly the note of joy and intense satisfaction is how this whole chapter wraps up.
Yeah, this is the conclusion here. This is one of those few times they end a chapter in a really good spot. This could be like roll credits. Everyone's happy. Everyone's partying. It's a great time. Of course, it never stays that way because it's not like Jesus has come back. So he hasn't even come the first time. So obviously this cannot last forever. Also, this 7 days and 7 days is the most Old Testament thing ever, where an author could say 14 days, and they said, no, this is a really pivotal moment. This is 2 7-days. That's what this is.
Yeah. That is a typical Old Testament thing to do.
How many days was it?
It was seven.
It was 7 plus 7.
Days.
It was 7 plus 7. So 14? No. It's 7 and 7.
Yeah. Yeah, especially with numbers. Hebrew is very strange, the way that it will express itself. But it's just kind of what you come to expect.
It's a big deal. They didn't want to write the word. They didn't want to write the number 14 right there. That's weird.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Why would you? Why would you do that? Okay. So hey, we finished.
We did. We got there.
What do you know? Three episodes, but we're not done. So don't hit pause on your iPhone or whatever you're listening to this on, because we got 10 more minutes. We got to go into 1 Kings 9, and this is going to be the second epiphany, second appearance of God that Solomon receives. The first one, of course, we talked about a few chapters ago. when he was a relatively young man, he called himself a young man. And, you know, it was. He was, at least compared to where he's at now, this is 20 years later. He's grown up, and a lot's happened. So God is going to appear to him a second time. And as we'll see, it starts out sounding pretty good. God's going to talk about hearing his prayer and sanctifying his house and putting his name there and so on and so forth. But then once we get to verse 4, things are going to turn around, and there's going to be not even a hint. There's a very strong suggestion of what is to come. So chapter 9, verse 1, soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house, and then everything else, all that Solomon desired to build. So it wasn't just like he built these two things. He did a lot of building, a lot of different construction going on. That the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. This is all back in 1 Kings chapter 3. And here's what God said to him. Of course, the first time he said, what do you want? You know, you want riches, you want this, you want that. And Solomon asked for a hearing heart, and God gave that to him. So he gave him this gift of wisdom. Now here, God appears, and he doesn't ask for anything. He doesn't say, what do you want? He just says, listen, that prayer that you offered, I heard it. I have heard your prayer, which you made before me. So that's the one thing. God is saying, I listened. And then he says, I have consecrated, I've sanctified this house that you have built. So this is God's imprimatur, as it were. He's saying, yes, I'm happy with this house. I have sanctified it, consecrated it. How so? He says, because I put my name there. And then he adds two other things. He says, my name is there, and my eyes and my heart will be there for all time, which is a pretty cool expression. Hey, where's God's eyes and where's God's heart and where's God's name? Well, it's in that structure right there that Solomon has built.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting about this is that God says two things where you're like, is that true? Where he says, look, I've consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And now, knowing what we know, like, is that so? Is that you better rebuild this thing ASAP after everything gets destroyed, man. We should be trying to get things together right now to get this thing built. I mean, this is where God's name is and where his eyes and his heart are going to be for all time. We got to get this thing rebuilt. Or, Chad, is God saying what this temple represents, what it prefigures, I promise to inhabit that, to have my heart and my eyes be there forever. If you don't read things like this, like through the lens of Christ becoming the tabernacle, like things get weird.
Yeah, then you're like, you're sketching out blueprints for the next temple, and you're gathering red heifers, and you're prepping not for the end, but you're prepping for that next temple.
Yes.
Yeah. Which just, you know, to make things explicit, would be a horrendous blasphemy to the cross of Christ.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
It would be saying, oh, well, that was really nice that Christ offered himself as a sacrifice, as the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, but what we really need are more animal sacrifices.
What God is saying, if you want, like, here's the Daniel Aaron Price commentary and interpretation of this text. What God is saying when he says this, that my name's there forever, my eyes and my heart are there for all time, what he's saying and how you can read this is, that temple that you just built, that's about my son.
Yes.
That's what he's saying. That's it. He's saying that's about Jesus. So therefore, stamp of approval for all time.
Don't you love the incarnational aspect of this too? Because he actually uses, doesn't just say name, but he uses parts of the body. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. That's when you understand it as you just explained it. That means, you know, when you see the eyes of Christ, you're seeing the eyes of Yahweh. You see the heart of Christ, you're seeing the heart of Yahweh. That's where he's at, because Christ is the temple, the incarnation of God. So the fulfillment of everything that we're seeing here.
Yeah.
That's all good. I mean, that's great. I've heard your prayer. I've consecrated this house. But verse 4 through the rest of God's speech to Solomon doesn't sound so good, because we have, anytime you have if, then, statements in Scripture where the if is requiring something of you, it's probably not good.
Yeah, I always feel like I feel like man has never lived up to the if then.
No, we definitely have not. And as we'll see, this one for sure has not been lived up to. So God says, if you'll walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I've commanded you and keeping my statutes and my rules.
I guess that part's encouraging, because I know that Solomon has lionized his father quite a bit, but since we spent a lot of time going over David, as if God said, if you can just walk before me like David did, I think I could probably say with some degree of confidence, like, I could probably do that.
So if you'll do that, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Yeah, so if David's the rule, then maybe Solomon can do that.
Well, I think we've talked about this before. Right? That statement is, if you've read a bunch about David, which of course we have, you're saying to yourself, well, what? I mean, that dude like murdered people and stuff, man. Like, okay, I could probably manage to be similar to David, I guess. But what's really being said here is that, I don't know, are you going to be a man who, not a man who is sinless, but are you going to be a worshiper of Yahweh only, right? Because this is something that David did not engage in, much like Saul. David wasn't going around worshiping lots of other gods. He wasn't doing that. And sinner extraordinaire that he be, he also is man of much repentance. And so I think what this is really getting at is, can you worship only me? And when you sin, know that I'm the one that you go to with it.
Yeah, that's precisely what this means. So if you're a man of repentance and if you worship me, yeah, then we're all good. Mm-hmm. We're all good. And by the way, this is a note about that translation, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. I wish the ESV had translated that a little more literally. Literally in the Hebrew, it is, there shall not be cut off for you a man on the throne of Israel. And the reason I say I wish they had translated a little more literally is because there's a play on words. So if you do this, there shall not be cut off for you a man on the throne of Israel. And the play on words is in verse 7, where he goes on to say, if you go the path of idolatry, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them. So in both cases, the same verb in Hebrew is used, karat. So if you do that, there won't be cut off for you a man on the throne of Israel. It goes on to verse 6. But if you turn aside, and by the way, this is, we should give this the Texas translation of y'all, because this isn't you singular. This is you plural. So, but if y'all, meaning not to Solomon, but you and your children, but if y'all turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments, my statutes that I've set before you, but, and here's our idolatry, but if you go and serve other gods and worship them.
Yeah, so what does it mean to, in God's mind, and I know we've talked about this a ton, but this is really important. Like, in God's mind, the way that you obliterate the commandments and the way that you turn aside has everything to do with worshiping other gods. It's not expressly a morality thing. God is not saying, if there is one among you who does not honor his father and mother correctly, then I'm out. What this has to do with the worship life of the people. And are they going to have fidelity? Are they going to hold fast to the commandments? That is, are they going to keep them in the sense that are they going to not disregard them? Are they not going to put them away in some library somewhere and never look at them again? Are they going to close their ears off to God? And while doing that, go and worship some other god? This is what God says you cannot do.
It all gets back to the first commandment.
Yes.
Every time. Yeah. And I hate to kind of leave off here in the middle of this, but we are at our 40-minute mark. So we will pick back up with the rest of God's speech to Solomon next week, and we'll see what God will threaten to do if they do go that path of
imagine if the people of Israel were not faithful in worship and didn't keep the commandments close. Imagine what will happen. Well, God's going to let you know not what might happen, but what is going to happen.
Yes, for sure.
All right, Chad. Well, we are up in chapter 9, and we will continue on with it next week.
All right. We'll see you then.